Coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, the Sunday show. 2.5 hours of debate, music, and hopefully at some point we're going to have some phone-ins, but not today, I'm afraid. The phones are still not hooked up. In fact, I'm not even hooked up. You're listening to a recorded tape. I'm your host, Bathrobe Spear Robert Norse, concerned with smashing the sleeping ban, getting civil rights for folks who don't have them, and exposing bullshit where it appears in public arenas. So, what you're going to be hearing today is some old tapes by me, around the issue of the sleeping ban, and more specifically around the issue of the political problem of Michael Rotkin. Michael Rotkin is a city council member who I will be debating on Monday, February 23rd at Kresge College at UCSC. And everyone's invited. It's a free debate. It's happening at 8 in the evening up on the hill. And the issue is going to be, why is Mike Rotkin stopping homeless people from sleeping at night and supporting a law that makes it illegal for people to sleep and cover up with blankets? And those of you who follow the station regularly know this is sort of an old issue. Unfortunately, for those of you who sleep outside and sleep in vehicles, 500 to 1,500 of you know that this issue happens anew every night. Every night people worry about getting a $162 ticket from the police or running into a cop who will give you a warrant check and find an old sleeping or camping or blanket ticket for you. And as many of you may know, we are circulating an initiative, putting on the ballot the whole sleeping ban question, so that the sleeping ban itself is repealed. We keep the camping ban, which we wish we didn't have to, but the idea is to pose this as it is, a basic human rights issue, the right of people to sleep at night without being arrested, fearing arrest, without having to hide, get into unsafe circumstances, without having to compromise their human dignity. It's pretty straightforward. What isn't straightforward, and what is often the problem, and what may be the problem in our upcoming campaign, if we can get this on the ballot with your help, is opponents like Mike Rotkin. We're going to face a number of different opponents. Some of them will be like him, so-called liberals, so-called progressives, self-described socialists even, who claim that, for a variety of reasons, this is all wrong, the sleeping ban is going to alienate folks from the homeless, that Santa Cruz is a fine city, provides wonderful social services. This would only compound a problem that's really a national problem. You're going to hear a whole series of arguments that Rotkin has made over the years. Well, today on the show, I'm going to play you some tapes of interviews that I had with Mike Rotkin some time ago. One of them is, actually they're both from 1996, a lengthy discussion I had with him about a flyer that I wrote. I think it was called Rotkin's Rotten Record or some such thing, or Rotkin on the Homeless. It was a rather extensive, detailed attack on Rotkin, which I hope to have up at the university on Monday, if you come on up and watch the Rotkin-Norse debate at 8 o'clock at Kresge College on the 23rd. And I actually had a long interview with Mike where I tried to encourage him to give me specific information about his position. And you get to hear us going around and around about that. You also hear the voice of reporter Charlie Phillips, who's a video journalist who was, I think, in for part of that conversation. This was when Mike Rotkin was mayor back in 1996. This was the year that he did what he could to crush the City Hall sleepers protest, which was a 7.5-month vigil outside City Hall to protest the fact that less than 50 people had any legal place to sleep at night, and yet the city insisted on defending this law, making it illegal for people to fall asleep after 11. And Mike Rotkin as mayor was the swing vote, and in fact still is the swing vote on the city council. The law could be changed within a month. He's chosen not to do it. He continues to choose not to do it. The question is, are we going to choose to let him continue not to do it? And that's really the real question, is not the sleeping ban pro or con. The question is, what's the most effective way to get rid of this guy, to get him out of the city council, get him off the political scene, out of the political scene here, so that we can actually put somebody in who has a decent conscience and a good heart and a willingness to take the steps that are needed to protect people's basic human rights on this issue. That's the question. And sorry I can't be with you here today. I'm taking a break. Hopefully I'll be in better form and ready to go on Monday, and I hope to see you up there, or at least know you're out there listening. This hopefully will be rebroadcast, the whole debate with Rotkin up at Kresge College on Monday. On my next show, Bathrop Spears Broadsides, which will be happening Thursday at 6 o'clock in the evening. We air twice a week, Thursdays at 6, Sundays at 11 in the morning. But let's begin with some background. And the background we're going to be getting is this tape interview with Mike Rotkin when he was mayor in May of 1996. But first, to spare you all the endless dialogue you're going to be hearing throughout this show, here's a bit of music, a little Peggy Seeger to ease the pain, or perhaps provoke a little pain.
Talking Wheelchair Blues. I went for a jog in the city air. I met a woman in a wheelchair. Says, I'm sorry to see you're handicapped. She says, what makes you think a thing like that? And she looked at me real steady. She says, you want to drag? So she started to roll and I started to run. She ran the pants off my aching buns. You know, going uphill I'd hit my stride, but coming down she'd sail on by. And when I finally caught up with her, she says, not bad for someone able-bodied. You know, with adequate care and supervision, you could be taught simple tasks. So how about something to eat? Well, I says that would suit me fine. We're right near a favorite place of mine. So we moseyed on over there, but the only way in was up a flight of stairs. Gee, you never noticed that, says I. No problem, the maitre d' replied. There's an elevator round the back. So we made it up the stairs on the elevator with the garbage flies and last week's potatoes. I said, I'd like a table for my friend and me. He says, I'll try and find one out of the way. And he says, is she going to be sick, pee on the floor, throw some kind of fit? I says, no, I don't think so. You see, she once had polio, but that was 20 years ago. But if the matter of the fact is told, simple truth, she can't walk. So he points to a table, she rolls her chair. Some folks look away and others stare. A woman grabs her little girl and says, keep away, honey, that woman's ill. We felt right welcome. Then a man stands up and he starts to babble about the devil and the Holy Bible. Says, woman, you're afflicted with pernicious sin. Pray to Jesus, you walk again. Then he goes back to his table and he sits down. Well, the waiter says, what can I get for you? I says, I'll have your special imported brew. He says, what about her? I says, who? He says, her. Oh, you mean my friend here? He says, yeah. I says, well, what about her? He says, well, what does she want? Well, I says, why don't you ask her? So, of course, he apologizes and says he's never waited on a cripple before. Well, she talks to the manager when we're through and says there's some things you could do to make it easier for folks in wheelchairs. He says, oh, that's not necessary. Handicapped never come here anyhow. Well, I bid farewell to my newfound friend. I says, I'm beginning to understand just a little bit of how it feels to roll through life on a set of wheels. She says, don't feel sorry, don't feel sad. I take the good along with the bad. I was arrested once in a protest demo, and the police had to let me go. You see, we were objecting to the fact that public buildings aren't wheelchair accessible. Turned out the jail was the same way. Lovely. Anyhow, I look at it this way. In 50 years, you'll be worse off than I am now. You see, you give us a name and then you give us a place, but we're all the same in this human race. Some of us are called disabled, and the rest of you, well, the rest of you are only temporarily able-bodied.
Peggy Seeger talking Wheelchair Blues. Recorded in concert April 27th, 1986. That's by songwriter Fred Small of Boston. From Peggy's album, The Folkways Years, 1995-1992, Songs of Love and Politics. If any of you folks want more information on any music I play, or if you want to get something on this show, or you want to make comments on anything you're hearing on the air, give me a call at 423-4833, or easier to remember, 423-HUFF. HUF is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the organization that I've been with for a decade, concerned with civil rights of folks outside, and folks who may end up outside, like you and me. But now let's get into that May 1996 City Hall interview with Mayor Mike Rotkin. Mayor Mike, or Riot Act Rotkin, as we later called him, as he essentially would threaten people with arrest at City Council and had signs taken away from the protesters because he didn't like what was said on them and attempted to close down City Hall at night in order to stop the protest. A series of measures which indicated, shall we say, a certain cavalier attitude towards civil rights for poor people. Of course, his position on the sleeping ban itself is the most basic attack on civil rights. But let's hear what he has to say in this lengthy interchange with me, where I was essentially investigating his opinions rather than debating him, although I think it turned into a debate toward the end. Specifically, you talk about getting the first public homeless shelter open in Santa Cruz. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
The River Street Shelter. Basically, the Citizens Committee for the Homeless had set up the shelter on Cedar Street, and where I, you know, was supportive of what they'd done. I actually slept there several nights as a monitor to train, because they needed to have people be monitors, volunteers be monitors. And then they were looking for a more permanent place where they could do something. And so I pulled together a group made up of business folks and social service activists, and with Pauli and Paige Smith, who were the ones that sort of started and initiated that effort.
This is when you were mayor, or this is the year after you were mayor?
I think I was the mayor. I think this was 1986.
Six.
Yeah.
That was the mayor.
Yeah, second time. And went around and started, you know, looking for possible places to have this thing work. I'm trying to think whether this was not earlier than this, Robert. My memory's not great, but whether it was in 1982 when I was mayor, actually, when we started doing this. It's hard to believe it was that long ago. So
the university sold the property in 87, and it was in 85, 86, they opened up the Cedar Street Open Air Shelter.
Okay, so it was 86, then you're right. So in 1986, yeah, I went around and basically we looked at about seven or eight different kinds of properties and saw, we wondered, you know, which of these might work, and there was some problem with each of the others. Lots of times they had to do with people not wanting to sell or the, you know, structure, real estate type problems. And this one that the university held, a piece of property on the corner of Highway 1 and Highway 9, looked plausible. And basically, I worked hard to persuade people from the Sentinel, business people, other folks from the community that this would be a, you know, sensible place for us to have a shelter. It was close enough to downtown for people to be able to walk downtown. It wasn't sticking them out in the boonies somewhere. But it wasn't right in the middle of downtown, like putting a shelter on Pacific Avenue or something, and basically was able to persuade them that that was something, not that they were all going to be thrilled by it or something, but that they could live with it. And
so your contribution was, in essence, sort of dialoguing with different people in order to kind of secure their consent.
It's not consent, they already had a consent to it, but basically trying to like create a situation where we would have public support for the idea of doing the shelter and not find ourselves in what we had found ourselves in, these kind of constant battles over people arguing we should have no shelters or shelters that are someplace else. Or
there was a prior debate in 1982 about the Corota shelter.
And there had been like five shelters. Corota was one of five shelters that the city was involved in the period between 82 and 86, where we, these are not city-run shelters, but shelters that private groups, nonprofit groups had wanted to put together. And, for example, Corota's shelter, which was going to be on land next to the Sash Mill complex.
It was
bought out from under them at the last minute. We'd already voted for it. We approved the use permit on the land and so forth. But then before they could actually get the final thing done, somebody else bought the property. And I think that was not by accident. The guy that owns the Sash Mill was, you know, trying, not interested in having a homeless shelter nearby. And did whatever, I don't know what he did, but did whatever he could to get somebody else to purchase the thing, and maybe even purchase it himself, or some played a role in it.
That's another...
But it was fighting hard to get the general community consensus behind it, and then working to get the council majority to support the funds for the thing, because it cost money to buy that from the university. I didn't do that by myself. It took four votes from the council, and probably a little more when we did it. Maybe not. We might have done it 4-3. I don't even remember. But basically to find public support for the
Do you credit activist work, let's say, by Jane Immler, her hunger strike, by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, and their kind of public, remonstrating with the public to support her in her hunger strike in 1980? I guess it was her second hunger strike that was involved, but the first one opened up the Cedar Street shelter.
I think each of these public demonstrations of different kinds have kind of a mixed response. I mean, on the one hand, they bring stuff to people's attention that otherwise they might not be aware of, but it also probably has a, for some people who feel like the particular people and the way that they're doing things or their tactics or, you know, what their views are turns them off who otherwise might be supportive. So it's always a mixed blessing when you have demonstrations.
Was Immler a pain in the ass for you, or do you feel she was a positive force in this regard? Or both?
Both. You know, it's like, depends on what the particular things were. She, I thought that the Immler demonstration probably was more helpful than not, in the sense that it brought public attention to the issue of hunger and people's need for, you know, support for the homeless and so forth. Generally, I thought overall, I had to put it on balance, I'd say positive, but certainly always has that underside that you're, that people are going, like, you know, who otherwise might say, well, I don't mind supporting certain kinds of homeless, I don't like that group of homeless or whatever and stuff, and so, or I like the homeless, but I don't like people that do demonstrations. You get that kind of response from people. So
how
it's
about
always
the
mixed
demonstrations? The demonstrations that followed in the, like 1988, your last year on the city council in that particular four-year sequence, when numbers of homeless people came to the council, there were all kinds of theatrics that were involved to get modifications of the camping ban, thousands of signatures were presented to you.
Mm-hmm.
Were those demonstrations productive, counterproductive? What was your sense about those?
I personally think generally pretty much counterproductive, and the obviously it'd be self-serving in the sense that it's like, you know, somebody who's demonstrating against the council that I'm sitting on, it's easy to say, like, well, you know, they were a pain in the butt and I wish they'd go away. But I think realistically one of the problems of demonstrations when people interrupt Democratic council meetings, when they this wasn't on TV back in those years and stuff, but people read about it in the paper and heard about it, that people have a sense that the people that are making these kind of requests are not the folks that they think are deserving of help and so forth. And so I think it generally undermines support. And I think we got complaints at the time, not complaints, but concerns being raised that the a bunch of social service funders like the Citizens Committee and other groups that were raising money for various kinds of homeless projects, that they were getting falling off of donations because people were associated, the people doing the demonstrations at City Hall, with the, all of the homeless in town, which is never accurate. I mean,
that was one of Fred Gray's concerns at the time.
Yeah.
What about those who were critical of, let's say, such projects as the rather expensive River Street Shelter, which provided at that time, a couple times, that we were doing a demonstration in 1988 for, I believe it was four beds. It increased eventually to 16 and then finally to 35. But there has been a perception from some people that a lot of money is spent on buildings and bureaucrats, or let's say middle-class jobs for social service providers and things of this sort, rather than the money getting directly to homeless services, the homeless people themselves, than the nitty-gritty tents, water.
Well, see, I think what that misses is the difference between something that provides people with some kind of an emergency response to their immediate need, or some group of people in their immediate need, and the kind of program that actually helps a person get out of homelessness so they don't just continue to be a drain on public resources. So River Street Shelter, which is mainly housed by people who have mental health or drug and alcohol problems, or sometimes both, what's known as dual diagnosis, I think those folks, in order to help them with their problems, to either get them onto Social Security or to get them back into a job if they're capable of that, is way more expensive than just giving somebody a place to crash, where you're not actually providing them with something that will help them either deal with a substance abuse problem or a mental health problem or anything else. So, you know, those programs are expensive because they provide counseling, because they have groups, because they give people a sort of structured environment to live in. They help people find connections to the bureaucracy, and that's expensive.
But in terms of the numbers of people helped, for instance, the current community house program, which helps, the current estimate is 40 people that is running at full tilt, so it could be expanded after that, replacing the campground, which served on an emergency shelter need basis, from 100 to 250 people at different times.
My estimate of the community, of the Back 40 project was that when it had 70 people in it, it was, you know, doable, and people, you know, was reasonably sane place for people to be. When it got over 70 people, the place was a hellhole.
It's not that I want to focus on that area.
But I just want to say that, but these numbers of saying that it housed 200 or 100, as you're now saying 150 people, at 150 people, the place was a completely overpacked place. We were getting complaints at City Hall about violence against the people there from other people that were homeless.
We've been through this before.
Yeah, but since you're taping me, I have to kind of, you know, you can then cut it later and sort of give the little part of it you want to run, Robert, but I don't think the place ever housed 200 people. It housed 70 people, and so the trade-off is 40 people in a structured program that actually helps them get jobs, get back on their feet, pull their lives together, versus 70 people who are just left to rot out in the field with nothing done for them to help them get back on their feet. So you're comparing apples and oranges.
I agree with you, Mike, that it was by design for transitional students. But would you support a place, a safe haven for people to stay and have potential employment inclusive in this, where there would be a job bank, where there would be a direction for people, a vision for people, whether it be Conservation Corps or something less of 30-hour part-time jobs?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have nothing against this. The only issue is finding a place where it can be done. Where will you find a place that's large enough, you know, for the numbers that you're thinking about doing, that is not plopped in the middle of a neighborhood where people are going to object to it? And I'm going to vote for projects over neighborhood objection if I think they're well-structured, reasonable programs. But where is the site for this place? Because the examples that people come up with, The single biggest problem we have is that they run okay at a certain size, and then what happens when the next person comes or group comes beyond that level? So, for example, up at the Catholic Church, they were doing something for months that people I knew and other people in the council were aware of. They had like 13 to 17 vehicles at various nights that were staying there. The father of the church was, you know, watching the program. It was...
Charlie, what I'd like to do is get through a lot of these questions. I don't mind if you guys meet later yourselves and discuss these issues. I want to get through some very particular...
Well, anyway, quick answer is, in general, I would support that kind of program if we had one that was well-structured and could find a place where it could be done and people had access to it. So I'm not against, in principle, the idea of some kind of a camp outdoor area or something.
The question is jobs. It's also the question of the needs of the people. And housing is one of the primary needs.
Charlie, can I get through this? I really do want to get
through this. This is Robert's meeting, so I should...
Yeah, okay. I am really trying. I mean, I don't mind.
All right.
I'd be happy to meet with you on time if you want to get through into it.
And these are important questions, but... Okay, what I was trying to say was that, or rather to get back to in terms of omissions that you're concerned about. You've given the criticism that activists are confused with homeless service providers and... activist demonstrations at City Council alienate funding sources.
I think people's confusion is between the activists who may or may not be homeless and homeless people. I mean, I think people see people at City Hall chaining themselves to the benches. They assume they're looking at a bunch of homeless people that somehow represent the spectrum of homeless people.
I'm not trying to misrepresent what you're saying, but I am trying to get to a point.
Yeah.
And the point I'm trying to get to is there are others who feel that your huge appropriations of money for small numbers of people produce a situation where you have a huge homeless crisis that continues. You have emergency shelter needs that are completely unmet for the overwhelming majority of homeless people in Santa Cruz City. And that's generally agreed. Like, I believe you agreed with that in April in an interview with the Mid-County Post. You said, if you want to sleep in Santa Cruz, generally speaking, you have to sleep illegally outside. There's no, at that time, with the armory shelter closed.
In the summer months, yeah.
In the summer months.
Not in the winter months.
In the winter months, there are 160 spaces in the armory at most.
Well, in the winter months, with the exception of 2 days, we had extra beds all winter.
You claim extra beds, but we know that there are many people who, for many reasons, will not go to the armory, and you continue to insist that means that that's some sort of voluntary homelessness or some sort of choice they make. It shows that you've solved the shelter crisis in some way. I think that's a misrepresentation.
Why is it a misrepresentation? Let's talk about it for a moment. People with dogs. Check that out. Mm-hmm. Two people had dogs. Now, there were 15 people claiming they had dogs. All of them had gotten a bunch of puppies, and other dogs picked them up in the period when we were talking. This last...
Two people?
Two people who had dogs for more than a year, where they had left home, you know, with a dog. It was
for
a lifelong...
More than a year.
Where it was a lifelong companion, where they couldn't let their dog go because they were tied to it, emotional reasons. And we could find something to do with two people with dogs. What we have is a huge number of people who found that all of a sudden having a dog was the reason that would justify your being able to go, you know, to be outside or something, and they gather dogs. So I'm not persuaded.
I've never heard that.
That problem. You have a small number of people who for whatever kind of complicated psychological reasons, don't want to be inside a shelter, you know, yet on beds, a small number of them, and so forth. You don't want to be indoors. There are situations with couples. There are certainly situations with a large number of people who are drug users or alcoholics who basically don't want to accept the notion that you go inside the shelter, it's no in and out privileges, so you're there all night without an ability to go out and look for drugs or alcohol. That's a problem for them. But I don't think it's realistic to sort of say that there's massive numbers of people that can't take advantage of the shelter program. Now, couples are people with
what
kids.
What percentage of the population have those drug and alcohol problems, for instance? Some have said up to a third.
I think that's probably realistic.
A third of 500 to 1,500 homeless people, and that's a varying stat.
Right, but I don't think that people who have drug and alcohol problems can come to the city of Santa Cruz and say, whether they're here, can make the argument to the city of Santa Cruz that they don't like our shelter service because we don't let them abuse drugs and alcohol in it. Tough. Like, my answer to that, that's tough.
There was, in fact, a campground area where, reasonably speaking, you had private areas where people could not abuse alcohol, use alcohol. There are plenty of people who can use alcohol who live in houses, because once they become homeless, any form of possession, becomes abuse. You know that's a form of discrimination.
Right. The problem that we had in that shelter before was that the people who were there were totally out of control at the end of it, which is what we heard at City Hall. People got up in public meetings, Robert, in front of the microphone and said, I live in this place down here by the river. It's horrible. Somebody got raped last week. I got beaten up. It's not one instance, Robert. We got calls here all the time from people complaining about it. So, you know, it might be one instance.
I was out there every day taking reports from people, and I got the reports of the violence that did happen. And I'll tell you, frankly, the picture I got was much different than the picture you portrayed, which seems to me to be a self-serving picture. You had no complaints about it as long as CCH, for its own reasons, wanted to keep that property open. The minute they wanted to close it down, you were there with the support of the city.
Well, the whole thing's ridiculous because the CCH bought that piece of property. It's their property. And
you're shifting the issue again, Mike.
Respond to what I said.
You had no problems about the violence, the rape, the drug use, whatever it was, lack of toilet facilities, CCH decided it, for its own
When there were less than 70 people in the shelter, which was the case for almost 2 years, there was no problem. When the numbers got up much larger, there were problems. That's my argument. It's consistent and it's factual.
Throughout the fall, there was more. In fact, throughout most of the period, there were more than 70 people. I've never known a period of time that I recall there were 70 people out there.
I've been told by the people who were there.
I know that from the summer.
From my own observations.
If we could find Ron Howard, who's disappeared, as you know.
No, he didn't operate on the legal permit since 1994.
And this pretext you pulled out of the hat about no legal permit, I mean, I've been through that with you before. And I'm not going to attempt we're here for a different purpose, which is to go over some of the...
See, that's the problem with the stuff here, Robert, is that it gives, you know, you're working hard. I understand what you're about here. But you're playing this game where you're working really hard at trying to, like, put facts and marshal them in a particular way to make an argument for yourself. All of these arguments about this open campground, the Back 40 as it's called, or the place down at River Street where people were sleeping outdoors, a piece of property was bought by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless to build a transitional housing project. And I think you're completely off the wall to target them and argue that you know better what they should do with their property. I think that's outrageous.
Okay, you're changing.
I'm not changing.
Yes, you are.
Throughout this thing, when you go back, when you lay these facts out there, when you say 200 people could be there, but there's only going to be 40 in the transitional housing, when you make the argument, Mike Rock, like enemy of the homeless, et cetera,
well,
you're not dealing with the fact that here's a group of people, well-intentioned, maybe you don't like their approach, but well-intentioned people who gather funding, buy a piece of property so they can build a transitional housing project, and you have the chutzpah to come in the middle of that situation and argue that you know what
Scott
they should do with their
Kennedy
property.
Scott had the chutzpah to start the Open Air Shelter Subcommittee last fall because he said specifically, you guys are going to have trouble getting permits if you don't deal with this open air shelter crisis. Your place is the only open air shelter. It wasn't Robert. It was Scott Kennedy who brought that issue together, and you and I both know.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Tell me what you're referring to. I'm trying to get back to where I want to go because you've diverted the subject.
I don't divert
you
the subject.
You do all the time, Mike. I mean, honestly speaking, you do, and I know you're trying to do what you feel.
The subject is whether the subject of my letter to you. You may want to talk about something else.
Right, I'm talking about the first paragraph when you're concerned.
The first paragraph makes it sound like I'm a person who has been heartless. Who doesn't care about
your first paragraph, in which you state
okay, go ahead,
that you have a record of helping the homeless in different ways. What I'm trying to get to here is to get specifics about that so that I indeed can make corrections in that record if you know, and additions. Because, you know, you pointed out that you know, I sin by omission, is what you're saying.
Robert, when I came to Santa Cruz in 1969, the people in this town were tacitly supporting the police, beating the homeless in the back of their cars when they were handcuffed. I can take personal pride and responsibility for the fact that we got rid of the officers that were doing that. It resulted in more than a third of the Santa Cruz Police Department eventually either being fired, resigning earlier, or leaving.
This is in your life. Now,
and you've never told people. I'm just lay up quickly. I won't take too much. Give me 3 minutes.
But your letter says it. I don't mind, you know, in completely printing your letter with this.
But my point is that you leave that stuff out. You leave out stuff that I played in basically turning the police department around on that stuff. You leave out the fact that I'm
can
not...
Can you be specific about that? Can you tell me what exactly you did to turn the police department around? That is one of the questions I was
asking. I encouraged a police officer to become state's evidence in a case that ended up with four officers being tried.
Name of the police officer was?
I don't remember the guy's name, but, you know, but the point is...
And how did you encourage him? You spoke to him?
I said it's like he's worried about the code of silence. Will it cost him his job? What's going
to
happen?
Did he come to you? Did you go to
him? Yeah, he came to me. Actually, a friend of his came to me and asked what would happen if and stuff. And I worked hard to get this guy to persuade this guy that he should take the risk with his career as a police officer to be willing to rat on his fellow officers about what he'd been seen going on.
Okay, was the police department, you note in the letter, and we both know that what happened was these men were acquitted, though they were dismissed, say, and the police department was reorganized, some were fired, some resigned, and so forth. Do you feel that the police department got the necessary cleaning it got, or that there are still individuals in the police department from that period of time who bear responsibility and complicity for that kind of organization?
Well, I think the people who are responsible for that are gone, long gone.
It was completely resolved.
That issue, I can't tell you that every police officer anymore than any other organizations doesn't have somebody in it that shouldn't be there. But
right, you should know
there's nobody that I'm aware of who was left from those days that somehow, like, you know, that
Sentinel reporter who covered the trial disagrees with you and feels that there are still officers on the force who have knowledge of what went on.
Well, then they should write an article about it. They have access to the media. That would be great.
Right. Well, I know she will.
Well,
that's what you told me.
That's between them and, you know, their conscience.
Okay, no, I'm not trying to criticize you for that. I'm just wondering what your view was.
No, as far as I know, we got rid of the people who were causing the problem. And you know, so that I did that. I spent a lot of time knocking on doors in this town. When I get people telling me, like, why are you helping these homeless bums? And I have to explain to people why homeless people deserve services, why the structure of our society is such that these people are without the resources they need, et cetera. I go out and do that. I go out and do that in neighborhoods with conservatives and other people in town. It's not something like where I sit somewhere and basically like hang out with a circle of my friends who all agree with me about things. I've gone out and done political work to change the political view of this community about the homeless. And then to be called as a result of that somehow that I'm an anti-homeless person or that I want to try
not
and make
this... Not because of that.
I say,
not because of
but
that.
By omission, to leave that out, and then you represent me to people as if somehow I've, you know, spent my whole life thrashing homeless people, which is what's implied in your leaflets, it's outrageous. It's outrageous. Now, it would be fair for you to say, Mike Rotkin's been generous to the homeless, done things wrong, you know, whatever, he's done these things. I think now he's doing something wrong on this issue, or that his approach to how he wants to solve homelessness is off the wall, you can use stronger language. Yeah, I wouldn't be saying the stuff to you I'm saying to you. Mm-hmm. But when you look at any one of your leaflets, anybody reading those would say, oh, this Mike Rotkin, I guess this guy must be, he calls himself a socialist, you point that out, but he must be this totally conservative person who's never done anything for the homeless. And that's, you know better than that, and that's what's outrageous.
Well, actually, I don't call you a totally conservative person, but let me ask
whatever
you about this. Here's a sentence.
Is this a fair comment? You think it's fair for me to characterize your leaflets as attempting to paint me as a person not misguided, who's got some bad policies about how to deal with homeless issues that you have bad from your point of view, but paints me as a person who basically is heartless, doesn't care about the homeless, and for whatever reasons I've unstated, is out there just to thrash homeless people?
I talk about your motivations in terms of whether you're heartless and don't care about the homeless. I think that's not true. I think you feel you're doing what you think is possible, politically possible in this situation. And you've often said that regarding rent control and other issues, and you say this regarding the homeless issue. You also state here that, and you've frequently said this, that Santa Cruz is the city that spends the most per capita in any city in the United States on homeless services. Do you have particular figures, or can you tell me where this figure comes from, this conclusion?
I did most of this work about 3 or 4 years ago.
Can you maybe give me some written material on this?
I don't have written material on it. What I can tell you is you can check the amount that we spend, which you can find, it's in the city budget, directly on homeless services for the city.
Do you have the figure for that?
Not in my head.
Manager, do you mean per capita, Mike?
Yes.
Per capita.
He means okay.
No, if you take the amount of money we spend in the city and divide it by 51,000 people, you'll get a number.
See, I'm wondering where you get this from, because you paint this figure.
That could be possible.
Didn't you say it's in the budget somewhere, but can you find it? I can't find it.
That's not a single number in the budget. You're going to have to go put together the different programs. It's going to take you like a couple hours to do it.
And you did this one time.
Yes. And then I went out and I tested it initially against a couple of the cities I thought were obvious comparisons, Berkeley, Santa Monica, Santa Barbara, places that seemed like...
This was 1993 or something?
Something in that area. It was after being elected to council, so it would have been probably 93. And then I went, and then as people made suggestions of other cities that I should compare it to, no, I'm wrong. I've since then compared it to Washington, D.C., Fresno. I don't know why somebody suggested that to me, because we spend more absolutely on the homeless here than they do in the city of Fresno. Washington, D.C., New York, Tempe, Arizona, Portland and Eugene, Oregon. Madison, Wisconsin. Anyway, a bunch of other cities. And so made the comparison to them and found that we spend more per capita than those cities all spend. So I'm always open to somebody coming to me with another figure. Bring me a figure from some city.
I'm looking for the data from which you get this, because I don't, you repeat this, but I don't see the evidence for it. I'd like you to show us the evidence.
I don't think I have an obligation to do that. I did the work on it.
You have no obligation to do anything, Mike. I'm just looking to see the evidence on it.
Right, fine. Well, if I get some spare time in the middle of this election, I'll run out there and find
it. When the election's over.
Okay.
Last year, the city and county and private agencies spent $8.1 million on homeless services.
That's from a study called the Continuum of Care that's available there.
Here. Okay.
And that's there. And that's a figure of county, not of private groups.
Right.
City, and
all three, city, county, and private.
And it also, it does... only list money that actually, by people's estimate, it's an estimated figure, mm-hmm. actually goes to homeless. So, for example, they might include...
the Planned Parenthood was included in that figure.
But it's not that they don't dump the Planned Parenthood budget in there. They dump Planned Parenthood's estimate of how much of their health care goes to homeless people. And so that's how the number is figured. And they've left out some. They left out, for example, they don't include the Westside Community Health Clinic, which now is merged with Planned Parenthood, but when they did the study, they were separate. So they didn't include that, even though I know that a lot of homeless people go there and get free services. There's other examples of that kind of thing. So if anything, it's probably a slightly low figure, but let's just say it's in the ballpark.
Okay.
Pretty close.
Yeah, again, what I'm trying to do is, again, look, not really to argue with you, because we differ on these things. I do appreciate your clarifying how you feel that you're being misrepresented. You feel that it's unfair. I heard what you said about that. Take that into consideration.
And you're listening to Bath Robespierre's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor. This is a 1996 interview with Mayor Mike Rodkin on issues around the sleeping ban on homelessness, which are going to be aired again in 1998 on February 23rd, a debate between myself and Mike Rodkin at Kresge College, 8 o'clock. You're invited to be there. If you have any comments on any of this stuff, please give me a call at 423-4833. And we'll be returning to the interview after a bit of music, kind of a break.
Ewan wrote this song for his mother. She went out office cleaning. She walks in the cold dark hour before the morning, the hour when wounded night begins to bleed. Stands at the back of the patient queue, the silent, almost sleeping few. Seeing no one and not being seen. Working shoes are wrapped in working apron, rolled in an oilcloth bag across her knees. The swaying tram assaults the morning, steely blue-gray day is dawning, draining the last few dregs of sleep away. Over the bridge and the writhing foul black water, down through empty corridors of stone, each of the blind glass walls she passes shows her twin in sudden flashes, which is the mirror image, which is real. Crouching hooded gods of word and number accept her bent-backed homage as their due. The bucket steam like incense coils across the endless floor she toils, cleaning the same wide sweep each day anew. Glistening sheen of new-washed floor is fading. there where office clocks are marking time. Night's black tide has ebbed away past cliffs of glass awash with day. She hurries from her labors, still unseen. He who lies beside her does not see her. Notice the child that once lay at her breast. The shroud of self-denial covers eager girl and tender lover. Only the faded servant now is left. How could it be that no one saw her drowning? How did we come to be so unaware? At what point did she cease to be her? When did we cease to see her? How is it no one knew that she was there?
Of course, was Peggy Seeger from her album The Folkways Years Again. Two songs, Nobody Knew She Was There, recorded in concert October 24th, 1981. Her partner, who's died about a decade ago, actually 6 or 7 years ago, Ewan McCall, wrote this song about his mother, Betsy Miller, who spent the whole of her married life combining her own domestic duties with other jobs, laundering and house and office cleaning. She died at the age of 96, a wiry, tough little woman, according to this, worn out by a life of drudgery. The song is based on the idea presented in a little northern England children's rhyme, "Oh dear, what can the matter be? Two old ladies got locked in the lavatory. They were there from Monday till Saturday, and nobody knew they were there." And the second song you heard was Thoughts of Time, Peggy Seeger and Neil McCall. That's Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger's son. The song was written to greet her 40th birthday, and it's been amended somewhat. Her 40th birthday was in 1982. I think she's in her 50s, heading for 60, Peggy Seeger is. Peggy, as you may know or may not know, is half-sister to Pete Seeger, a somewhat more famous folk singer, but frankly, I like Peggy better because she seems to be, well, much sharper in her lyrics than old Pete, but just a matter of personal preference, I guess. Anyway, stay with us. We're going to be continuing with the interview with Michael Rotkin, mayor in 1996, and still shadow mayor, as you may know. Though Celia Scott is actually the mayor. She only got in because the supporters that elected her and Mike Rotkin appeared in droves at council and demanded that council respect the electoral votes at the last election and make her mayor. But she still has not unable to get her people appointed to the committees. She's voted down in matters like the Pelton Street move, the destruction of the homeless garden project, which I did in some detail. We covered that in some detail on Thursday. So the real mayor really still is Mike Rotkin. He's there pulling the strings. Calling the shots, lining up the votes, and essentially crushing the progressive will on many different issues. But my issue primarily is the issue of the basic homeless rights around the sleeping ban and actually homeless services too. The destruction of cheap, widespread homeless services that were there for a while around the issue of the campground, which Rotkin and Kennedy both helped to close in 1995, and now we are going to be seeing shortly groundbreaking for a community house, which is kind of a halfway house, kind of prison-like project, where 20 people, I think, initially, maybe building up to 40, are going to be spending up to $600 a month to get into a system whereby they have to earn their phone privileges. I mean, it's a strange kind of way of presenting housing to poor people, to run them through a series of hoops as though their homelessness is their fault. But see, that's the current fashion in conservative think tanks that kind of allows cities to say, well, the reason homelessness is persisting is not because there's a maldistribution of the wealth, a lack of housing, no decent jobs that pay enough to be able to rent apartments and such, and essentially fucked up society. No, it has to do with the personal faults of homeless people. They're all drug addicts, alcoholics, crazies, what you will. They have authority problems. Anyway, the community house project is one of these glitzy projects which supplanted a campground that served 5-6 times as many people. And we have no campground in Santa Cruz. Instead, we have a sleeping ban. And that hopefully will change. But let's get back to this dialogue with Mike Rotkin from 2 years ago. Frankly, I'm not answering and commenting on the dialogue right now. This tape is being made in some haste, and so hopefully I'll be able to run through these matters in greater detail, particularly if anybody has questions and calls in with thoughts. But what we've got here is a failure to respect some rather fundamental things. Let's hear more.
It's unfair. I heard what you said about that. Take that into consideration. The food situation. You note that you don't say I voted against an injunction for food, not bombs, in 1993 because you feel that would be from 1993 because that would be a form of improper information to the public on a closed litigation session. You tend to indicate, however.
I I'm indicating that you lead to a conclusion of
that I'm leading to an improper conclusion.
Yeah,
is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I'll stand
and
by that.
And I'm pleased to hear that if that's the case. And I will, you know, note that. I would like to know what your response was to the arrests of people at the town clock for serving free food in 1988-89. Did you make any public statements? Did you remonstrate with any of the council members?
I wasn't on the council during those years.
I know, but you're friends with the council members. You have power in this town. Your opinion has weight. Did you do anything at that time?
Well, I was chair of the steering committee of SCAN. The steering committee took a resolution against it and argued that they shouldn't do it. And I don't remember actually what my vote was or something. I'm not trying to hide something. My guess would be that I would have thought it was a bad idea, but I don't
know. Did you talk to Marty or John or other people on the council?
I'm sure I did at the time. You know, it's sad. I won't be dishonest and say that I know what I said to them or something.
Did you make a public statement saying this should stop at any time to any news media? I recall this.
No, I mean, I didn't make any statements to the news media generally for 4 years when I got off the council. I thought I had my time in my 15 minutes of Andy Warhol fame or something. I let other people get involved.
The reason that I tend to say that, though I'm glad to see that I by inference, that you perhaps did not vote against this thing against food. Now, Bond, in your statement that the food services have not been directly harassed as they have in other cities, is true. Generally, mounting pressure on people to move, I keep hearing this from.
Oh, I'd love to have people move. I think, I've said this a million times, I think people have the right to being served with dignity, not off the sidewalk, but in places indoors somewhere. And I would love to see some negotiation between Food Not Bombs and any other group to find some location indoors.
Have you actually talked to people on the streets that they prefer? I mean, because the phrase with dignity kind of begs the issue. It's also true that there's a form of dignity in taking food to where people are and not insisting that they go hide off and to the side.
Well, I don't think we suggested hiding. I mean, I think we'd probably end up with some place like
a public
park or something. It's not probably about making it go somewhere else. But I don't think the middle of a busy sidewalk is the place to set up a soup kitchen. I think it's a big mistake, but the city hasn't enforced that since I've been on the council.
You've also stated that in terms of the drummer's laws, you feel that my analysis, again, omits the fact that your primary concern in these issues was to establish a public debate and discussion where the problems that concern some people, elderly residents who are being disturbed by the drummers, people whose sidewalks are being blocked, could be brought out.
My goal was to fix the problem. I had senior citizens who were complaining that people were playing drums at 2 o'clock in the morning, and the police department was telling them they couldn't do anything about it. They'd have to get dressed, come downstairs, spend 3 feet
right.
from the person, point a finger
right,
at them, which
right.
I thought was ridiculous.
Right.
And so I said, there's got to be some way to deal with this issue. Started the process. Now, what your leaflet does, and it's directly, deliberately trying to distort stuff, maybe you just didn't capture the meaning of it, in which case I owe you an apology in my note, but it implies that somehow I had like a hardline solution to this, and Scott Kennedy came along with this great fix that made the thing happen. But the reality is, I came up with a solution that had to do with a drum ordinance, presented it to the council, and a number of people came and said, we have another way of fixing this, Tom Noddy, leading them and others, we can work out an alternative to this. I said, well, what is it?
You may remember before you went up to the council, I took the main person with the main complaints to you and said she's ready to go for mediation. She said that to you, you kind of looked at her, looked at me, and sort of like, we've got no response.
I now know who she is, it's Valerie Slafke, but...
No. She was the woman that Kennedy criticized me for mentioning by name when I was at the mic.
I don't know about that.
Anyway, she was the most eloquent speaker around this.
All I know is, as
Lalani.
Having received massive numbers of calls from people at my home and other, which I encourage people to do in other places, complaining about it, and having witnessed it myself and having come down and seen it going on with somebody playing their drums early in the morning, and the cops basically not telling me they didn't have a tool to deal with this problem, I tried to make something happen to fix it. And the solution that worked out, all of us voted for unanimously, as I remember.
I know you did. However,
we accepted Kennedy's solution. Why was it Kennedy's
were
solution,
Were you not prepared to go ahead and vote that law in?
Wasn't another alternative?
Right.
Absolutely.
But you didn't propose another alternative, did you?
I didn't know what another alternative was.
Right. Kennedy proposed another alternative.
No, actually, Kennedy didn't propose. That's what's so weird about this letter.
You don't think Kennedy proposed? I thought Kennedy did propose it. He, in the middle of the whole thing, he said, well, maybe we could find some kind of media. And then he kind of went through this kind of...
All of us sat there. As soon as the people showed up, and I had already talked to people before the meeting, I can't make motions, remember, I'm the mayor. So when other people from the audience showed up and already had called us beforehand saying they're going to propose an alternative to us, and I had said, that sounds great, let's work out how this thing will happen, then we sat through a two-hour public hearing, or give or take, an hour and a half, two-hour public hearing. At the end of it, Kennedy made a suggestion, because, again, I can't make motions. I don't know if he moved it even, but on the face of your thing, I'll assume that he's the one that made the motion for it, which was then voted on unanimously. And you make it sound that somehow there was a split on the council in which the heartless anti-homeless Rodkin, you know.
No, what happened was you were pressing forward with this law idea, as was Matthews and the other people who had voted in essence for this at the first meeting, with the exception of Byers and Scott, I guess. Byers changed her mind at the council meeting. Nobody else expressed any change of mind until, in the middle of it, Kennedy didn't even sound like he was. It sounded like it was completely spontaneous. It didn't sound like he had gone through a lot of reflection. It sounded like he was just sort of stumbling with it. And then he said, well, maybe Tom could have some idea.
Well, he came up with it, and then you went
along with it. I applaud you for doing it.
It might have seemed spontaneous, but I had spent hours in meetings with Tom Noddy.
But for you to say, Mike, in your letter that you are simply engaged in trying to find solutions to these problems, you didn't say, here we have a complete distortion of reality. I've never voted for a law banning either street musicians or drumming. I didn't say you have, by the way. What my leaflet says is you initiated, in your second term as mayor, you initiated an anti-street performers measure that failed to pass. And
what?
That's true.
What anti-street?
In 1986, I got the clippings. Maybe it's stored in the media. We got Sing in the Blues, street music curfew before the council. We've got Santa Cruz mayor sings the blues about street musicians. I mean, what I'm saying is, you did work out a good solution. 3 months later, there was a good solution worked out.
Right.
But you introduced a measure that was harsh. Now, maybe your solution is come on with the iron fist and then come out with the velvet glove. But based upon your actions on the downtown ordinances, I don't see that as what you're doing here in the 90s. I think we would have had the iron glove if Kennedy hadn't spoken. I don't think you would have come up with another solution.
Well, I think you're wrong. We can disagree about
that. Is that right? I mean, am I wrong?
I think you're dead wrong. I think I went into that meeting knowing that we had already worked something out with Tom Noddy about how this whole thing was going
to
get solved.
That was his impression. He talked to me and said you hadn't worked anything out before he came to the meeting. Was he not telling you the truth?
I don't think he told you that. Or if he did tell you that,
I talked to him half an hour ago. I mean, you know, an hour ago before I came.
No, I don't think that that's accurate. I think he knows that we met several times in between and that we were trying to work on this alternative way of handling the thing.
Well, if you have another solution, then I commend you. I mean, that's all I want to know. If that's true, that's good. I thought that you did not have another solution at that point, and that it was, when the other solution did present itself, yes, you went along with it, and I commend you for doing that.
We're going to have to get out of the room, so we're going to go.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
We'll be out just a minute here.
Okay. Anyway. There's some of it.
Yeah, sorry, well.
I got some more.
Anyway, I don't want, you know, I did not write you back a public letter and stuff. It's, you know, basically back to you, and you can, you know, respond to it as you will. But I thought you should know that I think that the leaflet is very misleading and deliberately so.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to mislead at all deliberately. In fact, what I'm trying to do is clarify.
I think we have enough differences about things that you could easily, like, you know, be very clear about the things we differ on, and you could sort of critique my, or, you know, criticize my way of approaching it and explain why you think it's dead wrong and whatever, and still, you know, have a real clear policy difference with me about stuff. And it doesn't have to, like, play it in the way of, here's this guy who basically wants to thump the homeless or something, which is not an accurate representation of who I am.
But you know, you're a key vote on some very basic homeless rights issues on the council, the downtown ordinance as well. You know,
I don't think they're against the homeless. I've said that over and over again. I think you misrepresent those. That's your
every city council where these anti-homeless ordinances show up, they say they're not against the homeless. But homeless advocates, for some strange reason,
it comes down to the reality.
ACLU
that's what you come back on these
thinks
things.
They are. I mean, you don't, but we do. I mean, that's true. So there's a difference of perception on this.
Right. Well, the other cities that make these claims that they don't care about are not against the homeless and stuff. In fact, don't do anything for the homeless. And since the city does so much, we at least have some actions backing up what otherwise might just be empty words. I think that's fair.
If
we're an anti-homeless city, we sure don't show up on the way we start.
I'm saying that you take anti-homeless positions. That's what I'm saying. That's my primary concern.
What do you think about
anti-homeless? By the way, here's a copy of the latest street survey. Yeah, comes out in Oakland, 35,000 circulating. We got going late. I'd like to, at some point, conclude this to have some questions.
That was Mike Rodkin, mayor and now council member still in Santa Cruz. About 6 months before, Mike Rodkin actually came on my show. It was on December 22nd, 1995, and we had a long show. Call-ins called in, and we had our host, Celine Pascal, an academic homeless rights activist of a sort. I'm going to play you some selections now from that show, which may be enlightening, and may give you some basis for questions at the Kresge Town Hall debate, which again will be happening between me and Mike Rotkin Monday at 8 o'clock on February 23rd.
Yeah, those were kind of heady days for homeless activists, both nationally and locally. You were, of course, involved in the controversy around the opening of the first Cold and Rainy Night shelter, the Cedar Street shelter and Peter Kuroda's shelter, which happened as a function, in my reading of history, because of the hunger strike of Jane Immler after 6 months of organizing protests before the County Board of Supervisors and urging action by the City-County Task Force. Do you have any recollections of that period that you wish to share with us that perhaps diverge from mine or support mine?
Well, I think there's a series of events that are all what sociologists would call overdetermined. Lots of different things played into the final outcome. I think Jane Immler's hunger strike was definitely an influence on Paul Lee and Paige Smith, who subsequently formed the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, or CCH, and they opened up the first, wasn't the first, Peter Kuroda had already opened another, but opened one of the early shelters in downtown Santa Cruz on Cedar Street, I think, again, largely affected or influenced by the hunger strike that Jane was involved in. At the same time, the city itself was beginning to try and figure out what could we do more in the way of providing health services and other services for homeless people. So I think there was a convergence of a couple of different efforts. So I think it's always a mistake in history to sort of attribute what happens to one person or one thing, but certainly Jane Immler's hunger strike played a key role in influencing the Citizens Committee's formation, the first shelter. As a result of the Citizens Committee opening that first shelter on Cedar Street, the city began looking for some other kind of a site that might be successful as a more permanent location for shelter services, and that's through that process, as I was mayor, working with some of the local business leaders, some of the social service activists and others to locate the corner of River Street and Highway 1, where a number of homeless services exist today, the day shelter or Santa Cruz Community Resource Center, Homeless Resource Center, County Mental Health and Program, the River Street Shelter, temporary open-air campground, which I'm sure we'll be talking about some more, and so forth. And so I think Jane did play a role in it, but it would be a mistake to say she did it all or something, and she, of course, never would have claimed that for herself. She just played, she took an act, and I think it made a difference.
Yeah, I again want to encourage our listeners, if you have any thoughts on what Mike is saying or what I'm saying, you're listening to Mayor Mike Rotkin and me, Bathrop's Pier Robert, here on the Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides. Give a call to 427-3772. We can use some input from some outcasts or possibly just some ordinary folks downtown who have access to telephones. You can give us a call, 427-3772. And we're kind of starting on a low key here, trying to perhaps work into the more controversial aspects of what we're going to be talking about. Mike and I have had severe disagreements in the past and attacked each other savagely in different letters through City on a Hill. And Mike has even seen fit on occasion to threaten me with arrest, and I've denounced that. And I think we're going to get into some of the issues behind this, that the personalities really aren't that important. It's the principles and the concerns that both of us have, or at least I don't want to speak for Mike. It's the concerns that I have in this situation and that I would like to see him and the city council have that I'm going to try to bring up to him. Maybe we should just go for the bullseye right now, and then, we can kind of elaborate on it or dance around it or give the history of it and go into subsidiary issues. I have a tape which I'm going to be playing soon, which essentially is a tape of an address you made to the campers at the open-air shelter on Saturday, December, I think it was the 16th. And you came out to the field with Scott Kennedy, Councilmember Byers, Daryl Darling, head of the Community House, what I call the Trailers Not Trolls Project. There's been some dispute, $850,000 to $1.3 million project for 48 people that will supplant the open-air shelter unless another space is found for it on the property where currently the open-air shelter, which is has been, in essence, a campground for mandated originally for 75, but it grew to 150, 200. Even at one point we counted 250 people. Dan here can give us estimates. Dan Hopkins is a camper. He used to count tents every morning and count bodies every night, and he was kind of trying to do a pretty close watch on what went on there. You came out to the field, to the back 40, the open air Coral Street open air shelter, as it's called, 5 days after Paul Merceau, who is the head of that open air shelter, an employee of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which runs the shelter. 5 days after Paul had announced it was closed, in blatant violation of an agreement made between the Citizens Committee for the Homeless and SOS, Save Our Shelter, which was the group representing the campers. And I'm also going to play a verbatim copy of that agreement, spoken either by Daryl Darling or Paul Merceau. It's actually repeated several times.
I wonder if you'd play part of the tape where the homeless campers go after you for driving me off the field and...
You know, I don't have that on tape.
Oh, you don't have that on tape.
You should have brought your tape recorder for that one.
An interesting part of the conversation, I thought, when they made clear that they basically didn't share your
view
about
I don't
what
even
their
have
goals were, and they basically said you weren't speaking for them. So it's unfortunate that the same tape...
You've got to bring
right
your own tape.
I've got to bring my own tape. I'll try and think of that in the future.
Really, it's always very useful to have a tape recorder. And frankly...
Is that an accurate... I mean, that is an accurate representation
there
of
was,
response
there, there was
the response. Not all, but the majority of the
there. Was an angry reaction to by several, at least several, and I don't know if I would say a majority. Certainly a majority agreed with the plea. Maybe I should go. We should kind of backtrack.
Yeah, because people don't know what we're
and,
talking about.
Yeah, Mike was presumably called in to explain to campers what there was a great anxiety because Paul Merceau had announced, as I said, in violation of the agreement that had been made, solemnly made, between the campers and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, that there would be renegotiation if there were any weather problems. And no such renegotiation occurred. And if, in the absence of such renegotiation, people were supposed to be able to be there until January 1st with a 10-day notice, or later, depending on when the so-called community house permit was granted, because community house was the trailer project, the million-dollar trailer project that was supposed to supplant the open-air shelter and was, in essence, the excuse for closing the property, although it must be said fairly that in the past, the property has always been closed in the winter. Because of weather conditions and because of lack of staff and funding. This winter was to be an exception, at least in terms of the arrangement made between the campers and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. They broke their word. Campers were very anxious. There had been a drug overdose that I believe, some campers believe, is related to the anxiety and concern. Some campers have even called Paul Merceau and Daryl Darling murderers, by the way, around this issue. Because we don't know if this woman is going to live or not. She's last I heard, she was in intensive care. Do you know what the story is with Jennifer, Dan?
Yes.
Can't hear you unless you come in here and on the mic. But anyway, we go ahead.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, this morning, just a few minutes ago before I got here, I talked to her boyfriend, and he said that she's still not awake, but they said that she's responding well to the medicine or whatever they're doing for her, and they're talking about taking her to some sort of a convalescent home because they don't know yet if she has brain damage or not, and that's what I know so far.
Well, I mean, my
well,
point...
Maybe before we get too
sure.
far into it, let me just respond
sure,
to that one
ahead,
little
Mike.
Piece of the
go
action.
Ahead,
I think it's reprehensible to blame the Citizens Committee or the city or anybody else. A woman is a heroin addict, apparently, if again, I may not have the total story, but injected saline solution rather than water in the mix of whatever she was doing. In other words, made some mistake, and sort of blame that on the anxiety that was caused by people. It seems just completely out of line. People OD every day that use heroin. It's a dangerous thing for people to be doing, and to some blame that on the city or the Citizens Committee seems a little reaching, is I guess the word I would use.
I actually didn't concoct that charge myself, Mike. I was quoting several campers who felt, in fact, some of the leading spokespeople among the campers who really felt that the anxiety created had produced a situation where people were more likely to go shoot up than not. But you're right, heroin addiction is heroin addiction. I don't know whether it was heroin or something else, but I heard amphetamine at first. But what I then heard from Scott Kennedy, I found equally despicable. His response was that he felt Dan here actually had a confrontation with Scott, which I happen to have on tape, in which he said, how can you sleep at night? And Scott rejected this as some sort of moral guilt tripping and said, I wonder how you can sleep at night, or I have problems sleeping at night thinking that the campground is open and maybe that this drug overdose is a function of the campground being there, when in fact the presence of the campground, the presence of people nearby in a community situation allowed this woman to live. She'd be dead today if this happened under the bridge.
Yeah, see, these hypotheticals, Robert, you have to say, you know, here's a person who perhaps if there had not been an outdoor open campground would have felt that she had to go into the indoor shelter. Maybe she wouldn't have been, you know, it's the what ifs. If pigs had wings, they could fly. Here's a woman who maybe wouldn't have made her connection, wouldn't have tried to shoot the stuff up. Who knows what would have happened? And so, I mean, I think it's an unfortunate circumstance that she had, it was, again, it wasn't an overdose, but this response to whatever she had injected into her yourself. And
well, I still think
but
that
to sort of blame that on people or say that you know the cause of what made that happen.
I don't know
like
the cause, Mike, but I do know that people in a community situation. I know the cause that she lived, in my opinion, was because somebody ran for help and there was an emergency service there. If this had happened under a bridge, I don't think those kind of services would have been available. If this had happened in the Poganip, where people are many of those campers have gone, and I don't mean the 47 that got the luxury busing down to New Brighton Beach. I mean the other 150 people, some of whom went into the armory and some of whom are able to use a church program, but many of whom are off in the bushes and under the bridges and, you know, wherever the heck they can hide away from the police department and the camping ban. They have, I consider, a much more perilous situation than they had before. And I don't think that any reasonable person can deny that.
Well, watch a reasonable person.
Go for it, Mike.
Deny that. I mean, basically, let's go to a more fundamental level and start the conversation maybe there and get into it, which is...
Sure.
You can respond, obviously. I don't think the city of Santa Cruz or any community is in a position that it can provide open-ended, endless services for people who basically are not willing to find some way to support themselves. I don't have any illusions that the system makes that easy for people to do. I think people that don't find a way to make a living deserve civil liberties and civil rights. It's not a question of repressing their ability to exist in a community.
What about the downtown ordinances, Mike?
Which I'll be happy to talk about. But the having civil liberties and civil rights doesn't allow you to behave in a way that's oppressing other people. It certainly doesn't guarantee you certain kinds of services from any particular community. And so the city of Santa Cruz, and I'll make this, you know, a one-minute statement and go from there, is the city of Santa Cruz provides more social services for homeless people than any per capita, than any city in the United States. I've checked that against Berkeley, Santa Monica, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C., and Fresno. Now, maybe there's some community somewhere that I haven't heard of, but those are reasonable places to look for people who might be spending more than us. And no one is spending more than the city of Santa Cruz on these services. But we don't provide every service for people. We don't guarantee everybody has a place to sleep in the kinds of conditions they'd want to, or that they have a right to sleep outdoors, or that they have a right to, you know, a particular kind of food or health services or whatever. We provide some health services, some food services, some shelter services, the best services that people can get anywhere in the country. And the homeless themselves will tell you they come here because this is the place where they get the best treatment anywhere else. It's taken us years to develop those services, to build the public support for them. And my sense is that people who are demanding more are basically undermining the public will to even provide that level of services. So that's the situation that I think we're in Santa Cruz. And to say that we don't provide every service to people is an unfair charge against the people of the city of Santa Cruz or the city council.
That was good. 65 seconds. I commend you, Mike. If I could do as well at oral communications, perhaps I wouldn't be interrupted. Responding to a couple of your points, I don't think people are looking for open-ended services, and I don't think they're looking for a lot of expensive services. The open-air shelter was very cost-effective. It was very, very cheap considering the number of people that were served. We're also talking about the fact that let me go through a couple of points you made. It's a kind of homeless services, I think, that we're concerned about, too. And does the money that Santa Cruz may indeed spend more per capita than any place in the country, but on what? You know, when we actually have a campground, which was one of the original demands of that hunger strike back in 1985, that Jane Immler did, that we talked about, so because that would serve the most homeless people, the city council and the county ignored it and just didn't deal with it and gave it the runaround. And we've been getting the runaround for a legal place for people to sleep for years. City council dismissed the idea in 1990. Finally, it snuck in through the back door, I think primarily because people slept outside on that property illegally anyway, and it was becoming more and more difficult and also cost ineffective to go after these people. So Karen Gillette and Michael Dunbow did a deal. Citizens Committee for the Homeless said okay, because they purchased the property and they couldn't build their community house. They were futzing around looking for funds, and still are, I might add, to the best of my knowledge. So we have a campground that was working. It was working. And now there's all this talk about a health hazard, which I'd like to go into as well. I've heard no reports of a health hazard. But before we go into the new stuff, I want to again refer to what you've said.
There's your minute.
Okay, in the last 5 seconds,
take another minute. I just want to say it shouldn't.
I want to be fair with you here. You claim the homeless come here because we provide the best services. I have never heard people say that to me, and I wonder if you have.
I've had homeless people over and over again. Virtually every time the city council hears from the homeless, a certain percentage, about 30% of the people that get up, say they might like more services, they don't like the way we're providing things, they've got an objection about a particular issue, but they think Santa Cruz is a wonderful place, and they've come here because this is the place where they're treated the best. And I hear this from the homeless themselves directly all the time.
Really?
Yeah, so while Robert's up here, so I get another 5 seconds.
Okay.
I mean, I really think that the issue here is not that the city of Santa Cruz doesn't provide people with some reasonable place, alternatives for people to go, but there are certain people who clearly make a decision that they don't want to be indoors, that they want to camp outdoors or whatever. The city of Santa Cruz is not in a position to provide those kinds of services. And there's no question that when you do, I think if you provide people with reasonable services, that's the minimum that a community can be doing. I hear the argument somehow that if you provide any service, and I've been hearing this a lot in the last couple of days, that if the city provides any services, it will attract people to your community, and therefore cities shouldn't provide any services for the homeless. And I reject that. I've rejected it and fought about it publicly for years and played a key role with others in persuading the people in this community that we should be providing some basic services for folks. But I think when you provide outdoor camping for people, that it in fact does attract people to a community. And the cities that have had outdoor campgrounds, that I understand, Portland, Eugene, San Diego, and Berkeley,
Tucson,
have, I don't know about Tucson, but the ones, at least the ones I've looked at, have all closed their outdoor campgrounds down, every one of those cities, because what happens is, as Robert pointed out earlier, you start off with 70, and then you have 100, and then you have 150, then 200, and there's no end. And as recently as yesterday, people were coming to the mayor's office to ask, because they heard about this big controversy which got some press, where's this free campground? They'd come down here from Oregon. Where's the free campground in Santa Cruz that they're supposed to be able to go to?
How many people came
and
to your
there were three people came to city...
From Oregon.
Yeah, and that's just, you know, a small tip of the iceberg, I'm sure. And I'm persuaded that if you provide certain kinds of services, that it will, in fact, draw people from other places to your community. It's common sense. It doesn't require a sociology degree to understand that if you provide open-air campgrounds...
They said they came from Oregon to find the free campground, or they happened to be from Oregon, and they heard there was
a free campground in Santa Cruz, and they wanted to know where this was, and they were ready, you know, where...
They heard it in Oregon, or they heard it in Santa Cruz?
No, they heard it in Oregon. They had come that day. They had just arrived. They'd hitchhiked down here. They had just hitched down.
So the Oregon news media reported that there was a free campground in Santa Cruz.
Correct.
Wow, that's
reporting,
news to me.
And what I think they were looking for was the state park campground, that somehow that was now open to the public generally to come down there and camp for free, and the city was going to pay for a free ride, which was, of course, not the case. We provided limited stay for only until January 1st for 42 to 47 people who actually had been in the open air shelter before. Anyway, so I think I may be wrong, and maybe I'm unfair to folks, but my view is that an open air campground in fact attracts people from other communities, to that the small city of Santa Cruz with 50,000 people cannot provide for the 10 million homeless people in America. You and I agree on one thing. America's got a major homeless crisis. It's figure maybe 10 million or something close to it in the country. And what we disagree about is what level of service or what kinds of services should Santa Cruz provide that don't bring all of those 10 million people to our town?
Well, I definitely don't know the answer as to how attractive the open-air shelter at Coral Street is. I've never heard of anybody being attracted by the Coral Street open-air shelter. On the other hand, the mayor's providing bus treatment and free lodging in a state park for 2 weeks in a beautiful campground is indeed something else. I might travel from Oregon for that, but that is a completely different situation, and frankly, I think a rather disingenuous solution, and no solution actually, to an embarrassing problem for your, and I'm going to say this, I assume they're your friends on the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Come in. We hope you're not with the SCC.
Oh, no, I left the
TV. Of bussing people off to a fancy, not fancy, but let's say a much, much nicer place than they were at before for a very limited number of them in order to get rid of a problem that the Citizens Committee for the Homeless wants. The campers didn't even ask for this. The campers simply asked that they be allowed to not even fulfill the original terms of the deal made with the Citizens Committee, that they be allowed to stay till January 1st with a 10-day notice. Rather, they be allowed to stay until January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd at the open-air shelter. But I suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, that Paul Meursault and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless did not want to deal with the problem of protest on their site. So what they did was they had these campers essentially under the gun. And you put them under the gun, too, with what you said, and I'm going to play your speech to them, in essence saying the cops are going to come in, they're going to break up this campground, you can decide if you want to go to jail or off into the bushes or into the armory, that's what you got to decide. Make your own way. We got no free lunch here. That sort of thing is what you were saying.
Well, it wasn't quite like I didn't use the phrase "no free lunch."
No, you didn't. So. You didn't use the phrase "no free lunch," but you're talking about free services, and you're using the kind of rhetoric that I find uncomfortable. But more important than that, this whole I don't want to lose my train of thought, and I don't want to give you a chance to intervene before I've quite made my point. But I'm going to give you a chance, Mike.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that the original deal was violated. The Citizens Committee faced protests. So what they did was they got together with you, or whoever kicked down the money. I'm kind of curious as to who did kick down the money for this whole plan. And instead of putting it into a into a continuation and improvement of the services, sawdusting over the area, putting in some planks so that those could continue in that field without health problems, and they could have, and they can, and I think that is the case. Until there is a real flood situation, and even then we're talking about moving to higher ground. There was discussion of weatherizing it. Many had weatherized their tents and so forth. Instead of that, in order to spare the city and the citizens committee the spectacle of protest on January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, and the real wrenching reality that people are being told get out, or shoot your dog, you know, or get rid of your dog, because many of these people have pets and dogs. You know, you came up with this fancy, flashy solution of sending people out to New Brighton Beach, which I think is nice for them. I'm glad they have that solution. But they had no choice. They were not in a position to negotiate. They were under the gun.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I mean, the situation was partially as you represent and partially not. I don't know about what agreements were or were not reached between the Citizens Committee and Save Our Shelter. I wasn't involved in it. I understand some city officials, Catherine Byers and Scott Kennedy and Celia Scott were involved in it, that both Catherine and Celia felt positive towards the idea of having a continuation until January 1st, and their position was not that there would be an ongoing open-air campground, but until January 1st, and taking the position that the campers would have found that, you know, an adequate time to be there. They don't remember the agreement the way you apparently do, which is it was going to be until January 1st or for 10 more days or forever until the campground opened or something. But until January 1st was their understanding. Scott Kennedy never agreed to that. Consistently at every meeting that he went to made clear that he didn't support that he felt that there should not be a winter campground in Santa Cruz. The city's position is we have never approved an outdoor winter campground. We've never even approved a permit for tents on the site. We approved a temporary emergency summer shelter because that's when the indoor shelters closed in Santa Cruz. The last time the place had a permit was October 1st, 1994. And basically people just looked the other way as this winter when the National Guard Army opened up late, people left the campground open until the National Guard Army opened up. When it finally did, people stayed. The city, it's not just the Citizens Committee that has the ability to extend an agreement. It requires the city to permit it because we don't allow outdoor camping without permits in the city of Santa Cruz, so as you well know. And basically, we decided along with the Citizens Committee, we have a letter from the Citizens Committee saying, you know, we're the property owners, we'd like this place closed down. We got the letter, we agreed that we would close it down. We wanted to give people some reasonable time to transition out. We didn't sort of say, you know, you're under arrest, we're going to beat you all over the head or something. We told them on Tuesday at 10 o'clock, in the morning that they had probably till the following weekend to get their stuff together, to move out, to face the same situation that they face anywhere else in the country and anywhere else in this city in past years. And that's what was worked out on Saturday. I came to tell people that. If you play the tape, they'll hear that I was saying basically this place is closed. I'm not here to negotiate that. The place, in my view, and we may disagree about this, was unsafe for people to be. There was raw sewage running across it from a leaking porta potty, and the place was underwater. The fact that people might be able to winterize it is not the issue here. It's not like they have a legal right to stay. They're the property owner. The Citizens Committee said, get off the property. The city was prepared to enforce that. And, you know, we had never promised people a winter outdoor shelter, and the idea that you could leverage the generous summer shelter into a winter shelter doesn't mean that it was ever approved or that anybody ever agreed there would be such a shelter, including the Citizens Committee agreement, if it was as represented by you, which was only until January 1st. The last 30 seconds here, the campers themselves, when I met with them on Saturday, said, all we want is two more weeks. When you and a number of advocates, non-homeless advocates for the homeless folks, said that they felt the shelter shouldn't be closed at all and that, you know, they should stay open, and that January 1st was an artificial deadline and other points to that effect, the camper said to you, in effect, and literally, shut up, you don't represent us, we'd be thrilled to have till January 1st, and you said they shouldn't settle for so little, they should make bigger demands, they were being, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but basically that they shouldn't accept such a pathetic deal, they should fight to keep the place open, and we left the place. I left and went down to New Brighton State Beach because people said there was a rumor that the city was going to place people there, which was in fact not true, but that sparked an idea. I drove down with Scott Kennedy. We found that people could camp at New Brighton State Beach. So we tried to respond to what the campers themselves were asking for, which was to be able to stay until January 1st, get their checks, get their cars fixed, or whatever it was. You know, each of them had different kinds of issues. And so we tried to do what was humanitarian and respond to their needs, but not to keep the campground going. There has never been a plan to keep the campground going all winter. You would like it to be the case, but no one has ever agreed to create a winter ongoing campground in Santa Cruz.
Actually.
And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is a two-year-old tape of Mayor Mike Rodkin on my Bathrobe Spears broadside show. Interesting to listen to. You hear Mike speeding right along with one statement after another, sort of pillowing one on top of the next. Of course, what's lost in all that is the fact that in this particular issue he's talking about, the Citizens Committee for the Homeless did make commitments to the campers at the open-air shelter at Coral Street. The city did not respect those agreements, even though they were solemnly entered into between CCH and the campers. And when the CCH turned on the campers and simply shoved them off the property, the city moved in to do the dirty work with a whole bunch of rationalizations, which you hear Rodkin rolling on thickly, right over, unfortunately, the lives of the people who suffered as a consequence of his decisions. You'll hear the same thing on Monday night. You're going to hear a mass of rationalizations for the sleeping ban, a mass of intellectualizations, and I encourage you to come and try to pick your way through that swamp, through that dense jungle of excuses and fast talk that you're going to get. Well, let's continue to hear this interesting sort of historical piece, and it will perhaps give us a basis for looking into the situation on Monday, when we'll hear the latest from Michael Rodkin and from me. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is a recorded tape. Sorry we have no call-in line, but if you have any comments, give a call after the show, or call now and leave a message at 423-4833.
Need to create a winter ongoing campground in Santa Cruz.
Actually, there are a lot of things in what you're saying that I think are quite inaccurate and disingenuous that I want to respond to. Some things that are true, of course. And we have an incoming call, and I'm missing my chance to respond. Caller, keep calling, keep the phone ringing. I'm going to make a very quick response. It's true the city has permit, I presume, has expired in October of 1994, but the city has taken no action to close the campground prior to now. It need not close the campground now. That apparently was an arbitrary choice made by you and others to support a Welch deal by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. And I'm going to play the tape that shows you that it was a Welch deal, and it's not simply my interpretation of it. This may be the first time you've heard it. But first, let's get this caller, after which point we'll talk about whether the campground was underwater, which it was not. And you know that because you were out there. You walked around on Saturday. Here's a call, however. Let's see what that caller has to say.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Mr. Mayor.
Mike is fine.
I would like to know, what do you plan to do when campers start trying to find some place to sleep? Are they going to be charged with these camping tickets? And is there going to be a problem with that? Is there going to be any time at all? Or are they just going to start getting these $100, $160 tickets for not being in a legal place at night?
Okay, should I respond now? Go ahead. The campers on January 1st will be asked, their 14 days, which are the maximum anybody can stay in a state park, will be up. They understand that they only have till January 1st. That's what they had requested. They'll be expected to leave. From my talking with campers, I have a sense, and I may have these numbers wrong, that of the 42 people that were out there the day that I went out earlier this week, about 20 of them are planning to move on to other parts of the state, perhaps Southern California. 10 of them will probably go inside to the indoor shelter who are able to do so. And the remaining 10 to 12 people will probably do what they've done in past winters, which is find some place to camp out in the Poganip, under bridges, as Robert said earlier, other places where they are illegal for the camping that they're doing. The city of Santa Cruz has a enforcement on complaint policy basically around camping, so if other people see them camping, they'll turn them in. The police will come and arrest them or cite them initially. First ask them to move on. If they don't move on, cite them, and then if they get enough of these citations, I guess eventually they end up in court. So basically they will have the exact same situation they've had in past years, and of course the situation they have anywhere else in the country, which is generally it's not legal to camp outdoors in most cities in the United States. I don't know of one where it is. And they'll face the same difficult problem that they faced in past years. And the city has no solution for them. I don't want to create some illusion about that. We do have indoor shelters with plenty of space for all the people that want to go inside. We do have transitional programs for people who want to get into drug programs. We have mental health programs. The people who are just looking for a shelter where they don't have to make any commitment to any kind of a particular program, but just looking for some place to stay dry, do have a place to go indoors. Finally, the issue of the people with dogs, we particularly don't have a solution for their problem. There's at least two of the campers have had their dogs for a long time. I think everybody's sympathetic to these folks who don't want to give up their pets. Many of the people with dogs got those dogs in a very recent period of time. But I think the reality is we don't have easy solutions. There are some people in Santa Cruz who have made clear that they would help kennel these dogs for the winter, but that's not a long-term solution for the people's problem. They're going to obviously have to get their lives together in some way to be able to support a pet or find some place where they can go. And there's lots of even apartments in Santa Cruz where you're not allowed to have a pet. So, no, we don't have a solution for them. I wish the country had a solution to homelessness. We don't have one, and I don't know what to say, you know, other than the city is not going to be solving their problem.
A quick response, Mike, because we have another call coming in. Miami has been federally mandated to allow people to camp live in public, by the way. That's one city if you're interested in knowing. So is Santa Ana, even though that decision was overturned by the California Supreme Court. They are, in fact, tolerating it because of circumstances down there. There's not plenty of space in the armory. If you talk to Paul Merceau, you'll hear there are 150 spaces in the armory at most and 56 spaces in the church program. That's a reality. There are 800 to 1,500 people in Santa Cruz City, and by my estimate, that are homeless. You include people from the hills hiding in the Poconip and so
forth. Let's clarify one thing about that real quickly,
which is
there is space in the shelter, and nobody has been or will be turned away. What you're saying is there are lots more homeless people than the shelters could take if everybody were to decide to go into them.
That's right.
No argument. Stipulate that completely.
Right.
But nobody is outside right now who would like to be inside a shelter is being kept away from doing so. Would you stipulate that?
No. There are people who are drunk who can't get into shelters who are outside in the rain, and I've seen them there. There are people that, and also there are people who can't go into shelter for different reasons who are outside because of job conditions, people who are in couples who can't go in. You're making a I think the impression you're giving that everything's being taken care of is
no, I don't
want
to give the impression that everything's taken care of, but the representation that there's like people that have no place that they can go. The jobs folks, we've changed the rules so now people who have jobs can get into the shelters as late as 9 o'clock at night.
There's a 9 o'clock bus pickup at night.
Yeah, which takes people to shelters.
Right, but you can't get up there on your own. You have to be specifically at that spot at
that
time.
Well, that's the way people have decided to run these shelters, so they don't get so much anger from the people around the shelters that they end up being forced to close them down. I mean, that's a management issue, but people can go to a shelter as late as 9 o'clock at night, and so jobs are not a reason to not be in the shelter.
Carl, you're on.
A private person who had land who wished to help these people. But I understand that it's illegal to have camping on your own land.
Now, if people camp in somebody's backyard, nobody's going to know about it or cause a problem. I don't think, you know, people will hang stuff up on the technicalities, but if people have some piece of property where you're going to have somebody camp in your backyard, I don't think they're going to run into problems with anybody. You know, if they become problematic and noisy and keep all the neighbors up, then like anybody else, there's noise ordinances and laws people have to deal with. But the representation that somehow somebody who wanted to be generous with their private situation would somehow be stopped, I don't think we have any cases of that actually in Santa
Cruz. Mike, would you facilitate them if somebody came forward with a piece of property and said, okay, I'd like to set up an open-air shelter here. Would you be interested in facilitating that for the week?
No, it seems to me, you know, that what I would, she asked, you know, if somebody wanted to set up a place for one or two people to camp in their yard, I would suggest they don't bring it to anybody's attention, just do it and nobody will bother them.
I think
if you're talking about setting up some, you know, large campground that, again, will become an attractor, quickly become filled with large numbers of people and have an impact on the people around them, then I think we'd have to look at the particular proposal and figure out whether it was a rational one and whether we could operate it in some way that made some sense. It takes an actual proposal
Mike,
to figure out whether it makes sense.
Mike, you sound so reasonable. You know, that's you always sounded that way. I have to say, line of patter, which is so reasonable, but, you know, again, ignores the basic issues that the city did wink at this matter.